Mr. Top?
Chief Justice, Justice McCoy, Justice Meyer, may it please the court, my name is Eric Taub. I regularly appear in front of the third court in Austin, but this is my first opportunity to be in front of this court, and I appreciate the chance of being in front of you in this beautiful courtroom.
Absolutely. Would you be more comfortable sitting, counsel, because if
No, sir, I'm fine. Actually, I had a hip replacement a couple of weeks ago, and standing is actually pretty
okay.
good for me, but
good,
I appreciate
good
that.
Exercise.
Thank you. I represent Joel and Marla Ramsey, who are the defendants in the underlying case and the appellants in this court. There are three basic issues which I would like to address with the court today, reserving 5 minutes for rebuttal. First is the application, or the lack thereof, of the settlement credit. Second, the inappropriateness of the damage calculation under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, particularly the problem of awarding quadruple damages and the use of an improper interest rate and time for accrual of interest. And finally, the absence of sufficient proof of mental anguish to allow damages in the total amount of $200,000 to the plaintiffs, $100 each. With respect to each of these matters, we believe that the error was clear, that the error was preserved sufficiently, and that the law is clear that the judgment was improper. In fact, I would suggest to the court that this is exactly the type of case for the courts of appeal. Although we believe that the Ramsleys could have contested the entirety of the judgment based upon what appears to be significant error that was allowed by a trial judge who had obviously never tried a DTPA case before, we've elected to focus on the manifest errors in the judgment, which are mostly legal, because of the difficult burden of overturning a jury verdict based upon the great weight and preponderance standard. It seems clear, however, that this trial court, at the urging of the plaintiff's counsel, greatly miscalculated the judgment, and that the judgment of approximately a million two, should be reduced by approximately $1,069,000 to no more than $193,706.03. In the spreadsheet that we have attached as Schedule 1 to our reply brief, we show the actual calculation and how this judgment should be reduced. First, let me start with the settlement credit. While the appellees seem to struggle to find an argument that refutes the obvious calculation errors in the judgment, other than the failure to preserve error, the one area where they seem to make a substantive argument, although I think it is incorrect, is in connection with the application of the $400,000 settlement credit. Based upon the Texas Supreme Court decision in Stewart Title Guarantee versus Sterling, and based upon facts in that case which were remarkably similar to the case before the court, we believe that the $400,000 settlement credit, which was introduced as evidence at the time of trial and which shifted then the burden of allocation between actual and punitive damages to the plaintiff, should have been applied to the treble damages. Such reduction is appropriate under Stewart Title because the defendants in this case, the appellants, were alleged to be jointly and severally liable with the settling defendants for the same injury that was alleged in the live pleadings. In other words, the application of the one satisfaction rule. In particular, the plaintiffs claimed that both the settling and non-settling defendants were jointly and severally liable for actual and punitive damages. Courts have made clear that when additional punitive damages come out of statutory trebling, as it was in Stewart Title, then the settlement credit can be applied both to actual and punitive damages, especially when the plaintiffs have failed to meet their burden to allocate between actual and punitives. The appellee's argument that the language of Section 33.012 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code means that the credit should be applied to the additional damages of $2 million, which was clearly beyond the DTPA limit that was awarded by the jury and was reduced by the court because of the Spray's election of the DTPA award, makes no sense. And it violates the one satisfaction rule that is the basis for Stewart Title. The reduction of the $2 million in additional damages was clearly made as a result of the limitation or damages contained in Section 1750 of the Texas Business and Commerce Code and was not a reflection of the settlement credit. Appellees cite Crown Life versus Castile, Justify and Truly, which was specifically overruled by the Supreme Court in Stewart Title, to justify that punitive damages should not be reflected as part of the settlement credit. Castile is clearly distinguishable because in Castile, what you had is a situation, Castile, which was decided after Stewart Title, was a situation where the settling party settled after the jury verdict, after the jury had already come back and found that the settling parties were the ones who had punitive damages. In other words, the court could not make an allocation any different because the only parties that were accused of a type of injury in which punitive or additional statutory damages could be allocated had settled. The non-settling parties, the remaining defendants in that case, had not settled and were only liable for actual damages. Here, in this case, there was no allocation in the settlement as to punitive or actual damages. The plaintiffs had the clear burden to make such allocation under the decisions in Mobil Oil, Oyster Creek, and Burke versus Union Pacific, which we have cited in our on our briefs. And having failed to do so, they can now not complain and ask for a further remand since they missed their burden initially at trial. Clearly pursuant to Section 33.012B, and as reflected in the Universal Service Company versus Ung case, which follows Stewart Title, the settlement should have been applied first to actual damages and then to reduce the amount of the statutory trebling portion of the damages. Counsel points out in their brief that Universal Service Company, which specifically holds that, was reversed, but it was clearly reversed on other grounds, and the court made no mention of the application, which is consistent with Stewart Title. Moreover, as established by the Texas Supreme Court in the case of Battaglia versus Alexander, there should have been no prejudgment interest from the date the settlement amount was paid, since it eliminated the issue of the loss of funds from the date of payment. This, in addition to allowing pre- and post-judgment interest on future damages and mental anguish, as well as the use of a 7.75% interest rate, which exceeded the statutory rate for allowance of interest and made that judgment usurious, amounts to fundamental error. I'd like to address the issue of treble versus quadruple damages. It is incredibly clear that the trial court simply misunderstood and miscalculated the trebling provision of the Deceptive Trade Practices Act and quadrupled the award under Section 17.50B1 of the Texas Business and Commerce Code. Now, the appellees do not appear to dispute the application of the statutory maximum. They're not saying that the calculation is wrong, but rather they insist that defendants failed to preserve error during the trial and actually invited the trial court's error. I think if you look at the defendant's post-trial motion for a suggestion of remittitor, you will disagree. On page 3 of that post-motion, what defense counsel says is, and I quote, "The amount awarded as additional damages is clearly excessive under the DTPA because the DTPA specifically provides that additional damages may not exceed more than 3 times the amount of economic damages when the alleged deceptive practice was committed knowingly," citing Texas Business and Commerce Code Section 1750B1. In this case, the motion goes on to say the jury awarded $2 million in additional damages. That figure clearly must be reduced to no more than 3 times the economic damages assessed against the Ramseys as a matter of law. In the footnote number 2, trial counsel does make a miscalculation of the number, but nonetheless has specifically addressed the issue of limitation on additional damages by referring the court to the appropriate limitation in the statute. The motion for new trial, which is in the court record at page 233, also contains a statement that additional damages were, quote, excessive and resulted in a windfall to the Sprays. Finally, I'd like to address mental anguish. This is the only part of the judgment which we think is reviewable based upon the actual underlying facts, the other portions being clearly legal issues, which we think are clear and were adequately preserved. The testimony adduced by what are substantially leading questions from the plaintiff's counsel does not appear to come even close to the standard which was adopted by the Texas Supreme Court in Parkway versus Woodruff. While counsel attempted to use conclusory catchphrases in directing testimony from the Sprays admitted, although it is not a specific requirement, obviously, under the current decisions by the Texas Supreme Court, that they had no physical symptoms as a result of their concerns over their house. That's at the record, page 214 and 219, volume 3. That they had never sought medical treatment of any kind for any emotional concerns. That's at the record, 219 in volume 3, page 12 of volume 4, page 31 of volume 4. And they had not been unable to perform their jobs as a result of any emotional distress. Also at the record at page, at volume 3, 271. Additionally, the Sprays specifically admitted that the delay in the repair of the kitchen, which was one of the things that they complained about and which Mrs. Spray continued to complain about were providing her for emotional issues, was done for at least a year, not because of anything that the Ramseys did, but because of Mr. Spray's desire and his complications with his work schedule. And also they testified that it was not fixed as a result of the advice of their own counsel. In fact, all the testimony given by the Sprays in connection with the emotional distress is nothing more than a series of leading and conclusory statements effectively made by counsel over the objection of defense counsel without any manifestation of injury at all. Although Mrs. Spray said that she had lost sleep and had cried, which is about as good as it gets for the plaintiffs in that case, she acknowledged no loss of work, no physical symptoms of any kind, and Mr. Spray concurred, although he testified that his own work kept him away from his house 50% of the time. There was no testimony about the duration of any injury as required by Parkway, nor the manifestation of that injury in anything other than conclusory statements. The testimony here does not comply with the high degree of mental pain and distress that is more than worry, anxiety, vexation, embarrassment, or anger, which the Supreme Court required in Parkway. There is really no testimony to establish the type of disruption of the Spray's daily routine that Parkway requires. In fact, some of the testimony from Mrs. Spray relating to her discontent with her house involves her hearing, quote, critters in the wall, something that has nothing to do with anything related to the Ramseys, and something that Mrs. Spray testified was fixed. Importantly, there is absolutely no evidence to establish the fairness or reasonableness of a jury award of $200,000 in mental anguish when there is actual damages of less than $200,000. An admission that certain of the repairs had still not been made based upon the Spray's own decisions. In the case of Lefton versus Griffith, the court requires that a plaintiff show that they have suffered a high degree of mental anguish, that the amount awarded is fair and reasonable amount of compensation for the pain suffered. There is none of that here. We ask that the court reduce the judgment to the amount of approximately $193,000 based upon the legal errors committed by the trial court and the lack of factual basis for the mental anguish claims.
Well, what about your chart here that says 604,771, not 193?
Your Honor, we corrected that chart in our reply brief. If the court looks at the reply, it's Schedule 1, and we apologize to the court for that error.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Taub. Mr. Michel.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. I would like to take up the settlement credit application first. With regard to that, both sides would appear to argue in the alternative as to the application. Both in their briefs, the appellants argue that settlement credits cannot be applied to punitive damages and that they say they should be applied to punitive damages. We, on the other hand, it's right, not what good for the goose is what good for the gander. But before we get to that, the first issue I think the court needs to address, and I do think it may be an issue of first impression in the state of Texas, is, and, you know, unique facts give rise to unique situations in the law. And the first issue is we had an additional damage award of $2 million. Under the statute, when do you apply and where do you apply the settlement credit? We argue, certainly, you apply it to the damages. That $2 million, apply the $400,000 to the $2 million additional award. That comes down to 1.6. Then the court is left with the legal determination to cap that pursuant to the DTPA at the treble damages award.
Well, Mr. Michelle, common sense tells me that if you had $400,000 in damages and you had a $400,000 settlement, you have no damages to treble. So how do you get to apply it after the multiplier?
Well, that issue was decided 18 years ago in Stewart Title, Your Honor. That was the exact issue in Sterling versus Stewart Title. The issue, do you apply it pre-trebling or post-trebling? The Texas Supreme Court, Justice Gonzalez, wrote for the court. He kind of took a middle road position. The dissent with Doggett and Mazzi and Gamage took a lengthy dissent, well-authored and reasoned. But Justice Gonzalez of the court back in 1991 took a little bit of a middle road and rejected that. There were four courts of appeals that had held that way, specifically overruled those decisions and said, the public policy enacted by the DTPA would render that exact result. It would allow the wrongdoer to get off scot-free. It would delay settlement and allow people who came and sought justly and fairly to resolve disputes and encourage settlement, which the Supreme Court stated, Justice Gonzalez stated, was to encourage settlement. It would effectively penalize the earlier settling people to resolve disputes, save legal fees, and end disputes, and reward the dilatory, pay legal cost, and result higher litigation. So that contention was specifically rejected 18 years ago by the Texas Supreme Court and has never been overruled. In fact, they rely on Sterling to this court. So that leaves us back to this initial decision. You look back at the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Codes, and it specifically says under 33.012, small b, that you apply it to damages. $2 million was awarded as additional damages.
Well, if there's problems how you arrive at that $2 million, according to the appellant, correct? There's some quadrupling damages and so forth, right? So,
No, different issue, Your Honor.
No?
Yes.
Yes?
Separate issue. The first issue.
How do you get to the $2 million?
That was the award that the jury filled in on its additional damage question. That was a jury finding in answer to the punitive damages stage after the bifurcation of the trial. So that blank was filled in at $2 million.
So that's punitives?
Correct. Punitives, when I say yes, Your Honor, we've cited a number of cases that additional damages for a knowingly violation under the DTPA are punitive damages. So, yes, to answer your question, I call that punitive damages.
So is your position going to be that you apply the settlement before the cap, which means, in effect, if the damages are high enough found by the jury, there's no settlement credit at all because they're so much higher than the trebling?
And I think that's absolutely right, because what you're there getting there is you're getting resolution by the trier of fact as to what those additional damage should be.
Well, that's certainly not encouraging settlement. There's no settlement credit.
We're going to a trial at this point, Your Honor. What would be the policy?
That doesn't make sense. And
oh,
what
I think
would
it
be
does.
The policy behind doing
I think it does
like
further
that.
Public policy. I think it absolutely it encourages. What you're trying to do, remember, we've got the earlier people coming in and settling. We've got the recalcitrant defendant here. And in this case, this is a conservative Denton County jury who popped these people, no doubt about it. And an egregious, that's why I went so far of the statement of facts to educate this court to some degree, to the degree of wrongful acts, knowingly, intentional, and that's why they hit them for $2 million, because they thought what they did was absolutely reprehensible. Their own neighbors testified against them about this thing had been going on. The homeowner said, I don't know if we're going to be able to sell this. Exactly. Public policy, that's the reason why, is you want the wrongful conduct to be treated correctly, and not to reward them for somebody else's settlement. because these are going to additional damages, not the actual damages. So you're actually promoting an issue that was contested, that was fought tooth and nail at the trial court, and the Ramseys came out on the losing end, and their conduct was egregious. The public policy, just like Justice Gonzalez and Sterling said it, you want to punish the wrongdoers for the mental wrongdoing they do, that additional wrong. We're not talking about the addition. We're not talking about actual damages. They don't correlate. The people who settled didn't get that knowing finding that doesn't correlate from the actual damages over to the actual damages for the Ramseys. We're talking about the application of that additional damages or the punitive damages that they should be rightly punished for. Public policy, as stated by Justice Gonzalez, is to allow that. That's the exact reason they adopted.
But that makes the settlement credit meaningless. That you,
totally.
I mean, it's just you're
no, it, but you're ignoring it.
What's
you're ignoring
the point?
You're ignoring a huge fact, and it shouldn't be discounted in this case. The jury awarded a $2 million damage award against them. You don't just get that. I mean, and we see it now in hindsight, that's what they awarded, so it's not meaningless. If the wrongful act hadn't been so egregious, they certainly would have gotten a benefit of the settlement credit. You're exactly right. This is an exceptional case where the act was very egregious, and that's why they apply it that way. I think it's a rare case, but you can't just assume as a policy decision, as this court's going to be riding on, and I think it's going to be an issue of first impression that this court will be rendering.
If we wrote the law the way you suggest we do, it would be definitely an interesting opinion.
Well, certainly the statute. I'm asking you to apply the statute as it's written.
Do we know from the record in this case that the judge did what you're suggesting?
No.
The judge, okay.
No, we don't. No, we don't. But I think just as they're making a legal argument, I'm making a legal argument that a plain and clear application of the settlement credit is to damages. You reduce it, then you apply the cap. And I think that does tie into the policy reasons with what the Texas Supreme Court has tried to do in preserving these issues and not rewarding delaying settling parties. That having been said, now I go and argue 180 degrees in the alternative, just like they argue 180 degrees in the alternative. They are now asking, as he opened an opening statement, that you apply settlement credits to punitive damages. I wrote that down in my notes, Justice Casey. He wants you to apply settlement credits to punitive damages, which one is it? Apply them.
Where does he want us to do that?
Apply them to the additional damages.
Counselor, where does he want us to do that?
He wants to cap it down to the. He wants it to be. He wants the cap to apply to be trebled, and then he wants to further reduce it by the settlement credit. I'll tell you, there's absolutely no authority in the law for that application. And that's the issue this court's going to grapple with. But what I'm saying is, if you're going to take his proposition that you're not going to apply it to punitive damages before you cap it, then you're going to apply it to punitive damages after you cap it. That is likewise an improper argument, because they're saying don't apply it to additional damages here, but apply it to additional damages here. Now, that's an issue this court's going to have to grapple with. I just don't think it's the right thing to do, that they get a double. They get to apply when they get to apply these additional damages. Now, I will argue to this court that it's logically inconsistent to apply settlement credits under Sterling and subsequent cases to additional damages. It violates the very case law that they're citing to this court throughout their brief. The single damage rule says you apply it to non-punitive damages, first of all, and for which the settling and non-settling defendants are jointly and severally liable.
Mr. Michelle.
Yes, Your Honor.
Where is there in the Deceptive Trade Practice Act term punitive damages used?
It is not. It's called additional damages.
It's always additional damages, isn't it?
Correct.
And so when you're equating the need to apply the settlement credit against damages, how do you get to additional damages being different than punitive damages? I mean, you were making the discussion about punitive damages having been, that additional damages have been looked at in some deceptive trade practice cases as punitive damages.
Correct.
Well, I understand there's some discussion about that, but the language of the statute itself in 1750B1 talks about additional damages and not punitive.
That's absolutely the word.
So when you look at Sterling and you say that you apply credit after the trebling, aren't you applying the credit against additional damages because that's what's been trebled?
Correct.
Okay, thank
yes,
you.
Yes, you're exactly right, Your Honor. However, the cases I've cited have called the additional damages equal to punitive damages, and that's effectively what they were. The language of the statute calls them additional damages, just like in the insurance code violations when they get trebled, which Sterling was an insurance code case, they call that. And yes, I'm not aware of a distinction, Your Honor, and I don't think they've pointed out a distinction between the statutory additional damages under either the insurance code, the DTPA code, or the punitive damages. I've not seen
what is there in the record that reflects the method of the jury that the jury might have used in arriving at a $2 million additional damage figure.
Well, I think
punitive damage,
additional damage figure of $2 million, as awarded in the answer to the second day's
correct,
question about
correct,
damages.
Correct. Correct. Well, I think the record, how they arrived at that number, I don't know that there's, as with anything, you hear the course of the conduct and you look at the factors for awarding additional damages, and that number obviously is a number that's arrived at by the jury.
Well, let me ask you a different way. What is there in the record that preserves any error, if there is any, in the way that the question was asked on the second day that $2 million answer was given to additional damages?
I don't think there was any objection by the appellants with regard to that question.
No question of the form of the question? No objections raised?
To be quite honest with Your Honor, I don't know the answer to that question. Okay, I don't know if opposing counsel may know the answer to that, but right here before me, I don't know if it hasn't been raised on appeal as a point of error or an issue presented as some kind of defect in the charge. So quite honestly, I don't know that I looked at that to see if they had objected to the form of the question.
Counsel, would you address the quadrupling?
Yes, Your Honor. I think opposing counsel has somewhat correctly framed the issue for the court to consider in his arguments to this court.
So you would concede that there was quadrupling rather than trebling? It would be okay, counsel.
Yes, I knew that question was going to be coming, and yes, I think that's correct.
Okay.
I think that's correct. I will tell you back, I went back and I reread, I'm going blank on the case. Jim Walter Holmes that read that statute that it's a three times. I've read it, I don't know how many different times. I still don't know how they got there. I still think I've always have it since I was a baby lawyer, thought it was you get your actual, then you get three times, but whatever, that's the state of the law.
Counselor, the statute says the trier of fact may award not more than three times.
Correct.
Well, the trier of fact could not award $2 million.
That's
so
correct.
It seems to me that you apply the settlement credit after you find out what the jury could award, not before we figure out what the jury could award. Because they awarded more than they could. The trier of fact may award not more than. They could not award $2 million.
Correct.
So you have to correct that first. Then we'll worry about the settlement credit.
Well, I have a feeling where this court is going. I will tell you I respectfully disagree, because I think you've got to look at the application of 33.012 small b, because that's a legal issue. That's a legal determination that the court does it at that time to reduce it, and which he did do. The trial judge did do in this case. But if you look at 33.012, it's the application of settlement credits, and you apply it to damages, not judgments.
Counsel, in the interest of candor,
yes,
you have any concessions to make with regard to the prejudgment interest awarded by the trial court?
I quite frankly, I'm not sure how they came up with the – I've tried to look over their numbers. I couldn't get it. I couldn't come up with it on my own as to the calculation of the prejudgment interest. However, I seriously – they did not raise it below, and as the court is well aware, I think that issue was waived for purposes of appeal.
Wouldn't that be just a legal question that we could decide in, in determining what the correct judgment would be?
You know, actually, no, I don't think it is. I've looked at this issue in another case as well, in the case I found here that prejudgment interest is a waivable issue, and it's not an issue of fundamental error.
Well, assuming it's – we determine it wasn't waived, assuming we determined that then – would you make any concessions with regard to the award of prejudgment interest?
Particularly on future costs?
There were no future costs.
Okay.
There was prejudgment.
Cost of repair.
Okay. We'll hear in a minute.
Okay. That's one thing I didn't understand. I addressed that in our reply brief. There's three elements of damages: cost of repair, mental anguish, and mental anguish.
Over.
With regard to the additional damages, once again, counsel did, Justice Casey, to answer your question, if I could just get that.
Yeah, sure.
We in their briefs, they parsed the answers. I gave the court the entire quotation in our brief, that there's no doubt about it. The trial counsel argued in basically his three post-verdict motions that you can't get the $2 million award, okay? And they didn't get their $2 million award.
Correct.
Correct. What they did state, though, and you have to read it, the amount awarded as additional damages is clearly excessive and unlawful because the DTPA specifically provides that additional damages may not exceed more than three times the amount of economic damages when alleged by the DTPA was committed knowingly. Cites the statute, continues,
counsel,
in this case.
Counsel, I'm sorry, your time's up.
Sorry.
So you would say we could knock out the $45,000 in so-called future costs and calculating the prejudgment interest. Is that correct?
No, I'm not sure if I understand that point.
Well, it appears that prejudgment interest was calculated on a number that included $45,000 in future cost. And so you have said that there were no future costs, so therefore we could take that in consideration in arriving at the correct prejudgment interest amount.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I know you're – are you looking on the spreadsheet there?
Yes, I am.
Is it on the reply brief?
I've got all the briefs in front of me here.
They submitted a corrected schedule. I apologize. I'm trying to get on the same page.
Okay. Well, let's – just to move on.
Okay.
Mr. Taub. Thank you, Mr. Michelle.
Thank you.
Briefly, Your Honor. Appreciate counsel's mental gymnastics in trying to get to this issue on the $2 million, but obviously, as Justice McCoy has observed, you can't get there. They made an election of the DTPA. DTPA puts a limit under Section 1750 of three times actuals. You then apply the settlement credit to the three times actuals. That is certainly the additional damages. In other words, the $2 million figure awarded by the jury without any basis should be disregarded. The court properly limited the additional damages statutorily allowed under the DTPA, but didn't apply the settlement credit after that application. They made the DTPA election. There was a limitation. The settlement credit should have been applied. Justice Meyer, as you've observed, it is very clear that what Stewart Title allows and what Universal versus Ung following Stewart Title allows is an application of settlement credit against additional damages, sometimes referred to as punitive damages, but additional damages. That's exactly what happened in Stewart Title, and in fact, in the exact amount that's before the court in settlement credit, $400,000. What they should have done, what the court should have done, is determine the appropriate amount of the additional damages, then applied the settlement credit against actuals and additional damages. Clearly, the court did not do that, and that is our calculation that we provided in Schedule 1 of our reply brief.
What about the 45? Okay, go ahead.
Mr. Tom, you left out the mental anguish portions on your theory that they're not entitled to any.
Yes, sir, you did.
And do you concede that the language in the statute at 1750B number 1 allows trebling of both anguish, mental anguish damages, and out-of-pocket expenses that relate to actual damages?
I do concede that, Your Honor. My point and the way we've calculated in the brief is because the evidence before the court didn't come close to establishing the requirements in Parkway, that it shouldn't be included, and that's how we've calculated.
I understand. And then when you read the actual response to the questions asked in terms of dollar amounts, we don't have the same dollar amounts that are on your spreadsheet.
The reason, Your Honor, is twofold. First of all, as Justice McCoy observed, there was a $45,000 additional damage amount, in other words, future damages, which, of course, the court calculated pre-judgment interest against and post-judgment interest against, which was inappropriate. But there was $15,000 worth of credit, $15,000 worth of damage that related to a fence that was damaged as a result of, as I recall, it was some type of
hailstorm.
Thank you.
Well, I understand your discussion there. What I'm asking you is how did you get away from the answers that the jury gave in arriving at your spreadsheet?
The only way to do that is to subtract the $15,000. That's how we got to that number.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah, you gave us a spreadsheet that showed us numbers, actual numbers, and then numbers that you proposed based on your legal arguments that the damages and awards should be, so forth.
Yes, sir. We actually compared the actuals to the way we thought it should be based upon what was in the record, and particularly as it related to the mental anguish. We appreciate the attention of the court, and thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Taub. Mr. Michelle, very interesting case. We appreciate both of you appearing here this morning to present your arguments. Case is submitted, and you're both excused.